From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, following a week of watching and waiting, no indictment of former President Donald Trump.
The prospect of a former president being arrested for the first time, it is such an unprecedented moment in American history.
Dangerous data stealer or creative new way of communicating? TikTok front and center on Capitol Hill.
There's so much about it that we're grateful for, like the potential to grow so quickly. Like no other platform has that.
And it's been 20 years since the start of the war in Iraq, but the scars remain for the Marines who fought it.
My experience in Iraq just involved witnessing suffering after suffering. How do I have meaning in my life when I felt really powerless in Iraq? I felt trapped.
All ahead on Perspective. The week began with anticipation. Former President Donald Trump saying that he expected to be arrested on Tuesday and calling on his supporters to protest as a Manhattan grand jury weighed criminal charges in connection with the investigation into alleged hush money payments made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Security was ramped up across New York. Reporters took their places outside the Manhattan DA's office, and a handful of people, both Trump supporters and opponents, showed up waving flags and holding signs. As we recorded our show, though, there was no indictment, and one wasn't expected this week. One of the reporters who took his place outside the criminal courthouse of New York, our senior investigative correspondent, Aaron Katursky, who joins us now. Aaron, for those who haven't been watching it 24/7, what exactly happened this week?
In a way, Sherry, nothing happened other than what's been happening, which is a grand jury hearing evidence of former President Trump's role in the hush payment to porn actress Stormy Daniels in 2016. Was taking testimony. Former President Trump himself had said on social media last weekend that he expected to be arrested on Tuesday, and he called for protest. And a spokesman later said he had no knowledge that he would be arrested Tuesday, but the possibility and the prospect of a former president being arrested for the first time really, I think, made a convergence on the criminal courthouse in Manhattan. Because it is such an unprecedented moment in American history.
Okay, this is far from the only legal case that Donald Trump is facing. We've got a number of them, and we had a number of significant things that happened this week in some of these. Let's start with what happened in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case.
This had been before a federal judge in Washington, and the special counsel is investigating how Trump handled classified material after he left the White House. And we learned that a judge had become convinced that prosecutors, at least so far, had developed preliminarily a pretty good case of a criminal scheme that the former president may well have been involved in. This does not mean criminal charges are definitive. This does not mean guilt is assured. Attorney-client privilege is normally ironclad. But when there's a potential crime involved, the attorney-client privilege is off. And this judge said that Evan Corcoran could come before the grand jury to testify.
Where are we timing-wise with that case? I mean, what are the next developments we expect to see in that?
It's a grand jury proceeding. The special counsel is going through that. The special counsel is also investigating Trump's role on January 6th. And a prosecutor in Georgia, in Fulton County, is investigating the efforts to overturn the 2020 election. And so all of this taken together is this sort of swirl of legal proceedings around Trump. There are also civil proceedings. He's facing a potential trial in April over an alleged defamation of writer E. Jean Carroll. He's facing a civil lawsuit by the New York Attorney General's office that's seeking $250 million from his company. So he's got it on all fronts.
When you take all those into account, January 6th, what happened in Georgia, the Mar-a-Lago classified documents, is there any one that stands out to you, obviously the Stormy Daniels case as well, that stands out to you as the one that is maybe perhaps the most serious?
I think prosecutors would say they're all serious because that's why they're looking at them and the potential for criminal charges. Any of the cases could be serious for Trump if he does, in fact, get indicted. The Manhattan DA case seems to be the farthest along and nearest to a charging decision from what we know. And that's the one that to the public may seem the least consequential. You're talking about basically it's a private company, not a whole lot of money. It made an error in a checkbook 7 years ago. Does that seem like an urgent priority compared to, say, tampering with the election results in Georgia or inciting violence on January 6th? In the public eye, maybe not. But to prosecutors, they believe that falsifying business records, which is where the case seems to be headed if it does get charged, is kind of a right in the wheelhouse of the Manhattan DA's office, whose backyard includes Wall Street.
Okay, ABC's Aaron Katursky, we know you'll be there.
Thank you, Sherry.
The former president has maintained his innocence on all the accusations he's facing. It's really stunning how quickly technology has been changing the world. Case in point, TikTok, owned by the Chinese company ByteDance. It took off for real in this country only 3 years ago, and in that time, 150 million Americans have begun creating short video content that makes us laugh, think, and in some cases, buy stuff. Influencers are making real money off the app. Some have quit their jobs, and now TikTok is their full-time job. But how worried should we be about security that some, including a lot of U.S. lawmakers, say is being compromised every time we open it up? TikTok's founder appeared on Capitol Hill this week. Here's ABC Tech reporter Mike Dubusky.
If you've scrolled through your social feeds in the past couple of days, you may have seen some of your favorite influencers congregating in a familiar spot.
Hi guys, I'm here outside of Lindsey Graham's office. Here
online personalities with handles like Sparks of Joy Co. and Dad Life Jason were in Washington this week with a mission from TikTok. Demonstrate to lawmakers how important the app is.
Well, we're here to tell our story of how TikTok has affected our lives.
It was part of a broader charm offensive from the popular social media platform.
Hi, everyone. It's Sho here.
One that included CEO Shouzi Chu posting a TikTok earlier in the week about his own DC trip.
Let me know in the comments what you want your elected representatives to know about what you love about TikTok.
All of it came ahead of Chu's first appearance on Capitol Hill on Thursday.
The committee will come to order.
And it comes against the backdrop of a political environment becoming increasingly more hostile to TikTok.
You'll say anything to avoid this outcome.
Lawmakers are raising a number of concerns about TikTok, but the big one has to do with the information the app collects on its users. Unlike other social platforms that are popular among Americans like Facebook or Twitter, TikTok is owned by a Chinese company, ByteDance. Taylor Barkley is the director for technology and innovation at the Center for Growth and Opportunity.
At any moment, the Chinese Communist Party can say to ByteDance, hey, we want all the information TikTok has on Americans. And I think that's why the U.S. government should be scrutinizing TikTok.
Last year, BuzzFeed uncovered internal TikTok recordings that found ByteDance employees in China had repeatedly accessed non-public data on U.S. users. The Department of Justice, meanwhile, recently opened an investigation into allegations the company illegally surveilled journalists. Though it's worth mentioning that there is still no definitive proof that the Chinese government ordered the collection of information on Americans through TikTok. During his testimony, Chu weighed in on his company's allegiances.
The bottom line is this: American data stored on American soil by an American company overseen by American personnel.
He's talking there about Project Texas, an effort that he says keeps all American user data in America. That's done through a partnership with Oracle, an American tech company. But he also admitted that some older data collected on Americans is still stored abroad.
We have legacy US data sitting in our servers in Virginia and in Singapore. We're deleting those, and we expect that to be complete this year.
Data finding its way back to China isn't the only concern lawmakers have about TikTok.
Mr. Chu, your algorithms have prioritized providing harmful content directly to children.
A recent study from the Center for Countering Digital Hate found that the time it takes for TikTok's algorithm to show teenagers harmful content is only about 39 seconds. Chu notes that the company has rolled out new features for teens, throwing up warning messages if they've been scrolling for too long, and limiting direct messages for users under 16. But Barkley says all Chu's counterarguments, whether they be about harmful content or international espionage, might not be enough for lawmakers.
There's disagreement on the details between Republicans and Democrats on what a good privacy law could look like, but there's, you know, agreement that something should be done.
Both the House and Senate are considering bills that could lead to a ban on TikTok in the United States. The White House has thrown its support behind the Senate version, and it's also issued an ultimatum to ByteDance, saying that company has to divest from its American operations or they'll ban it. But new research finds that a ban might not actually solve the problems Washington has with TikTok. A recent cybersecurity report obtained by ABC News found that TikTok could collect and transfer data even if the app is deleted off of one's phone. And according to some, a ban could backfire politically as well, particularly on the party in power. Jamie Cohen is an assistant media studies professor at CUNY Queens College.
I think there could be a big blame game going on, trying to figure out who's wronged the young people. And at a period of time where young people are really doing their best to become politically engaged, this could actually cause a reactionary movement.
Cohen says TikTok has become a hub for online conversation.
I would expressly say that TikTok is the primary culture delivery system at this moment.
I owe so much to it. And it's brought me this like incredible community of people.
Amelia Sampson is a TikTok creator with more than 500,000 followers. She says amassing an audience on the platform brings with it a strong community of fans and, through brand partnerships, money as well.
Advertisers have recognized the benefit of utilizing a creator's audience.
On Tuesday in Shochu's TikTok, he revealed the platform's new MAU number, basically how many people open the app every month. According to him, in the U.S., that's about 150 million people.
It's going to absolutely suck if it disappears because there's so much about it that we're grateful for, like the potential to grow so quickly. Like, no other platform has that.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
Coming up 20 years since the start of the U.S. war in Iraq, its lasting impact on three veterans on Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Sherry Preston. The war in Iraq began 20 years ago this week. The stated objective back in 2003 to remove Saddam Hussein, free the Iraqi people from his dictatorship, and destroy alleged weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein was captured 9 months into the invasion, but the war raged on for 8 years, killing hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians and more than 4,000 U.S. military forces. Weapons of mass destruction were never found. ABC News was there when Marine Battalion Fox 25 shipped out to fight the war, and we were there this past week when three of those Marines spoke candidly about their time in Iraq with ABC's Byron Pitts.
20 years ago, their mission in Kuwait was off to a slow start, standing by for official orders.
Hey, we're all out here together. We're all going to kick together, right?
21-year-old Lance Corporal Josh Heisel performing at a military talent show.
I still just remember it being this one evening for a minute where, because it was such a good time that you almost forgot.
Thanks a lot, Fox. Thanks, everybody else.
21-year-old Corporal Michael Elliott reading a book his mother had slipped in his pack.
It's called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, Simple Ways to Keep Yourself Cool in Stressful Times. And I figured the next few months of my life would probably be the most stressful times I've ever endured.
I have empathy for that kid that I see that just wanted to serve his country and didn't know the ramifications of that.
And 32-year-old Captain Terry Johnson, with no prior battlefield experience, the measured and steady commander of Fox 25.
If you've never been to combat and you haven't experienced it, you don't know how things are going to go.
War is a very serious undertaking and it has consequences. 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, 3rd Battalion.
All these years later, still Semper Fi, always faithful.
Do you believe America's involvement in Iraq was worth the price that was paid?
I think it was worth it. Clearly, Saddam was a bad individual, was a dictator of classic proportions, was extremely brutal to his people.
But even faith can erode with time.
The war took a big toll on my life. The military and war threw me into the deep end.
I have all this gear on and all this cool stuff on.
The young Marines, now full adults, once again sharing their journeys. Captain Johnson completed many more deployments in Iraq.
It's never been a job. It's always been very natural. I'm very grateful for this profession.
Corporal Heisel finished one more deployment, leaving 2 weeks after his wife gave birth to their first child.
I always had a certain amount of guilt while I was over there for being there at all, for leaving my ride or die lady back here with the kid, you know, and going and doing this.
Though he still plays his guitar, the tune is different.
I was staring.
Once you start to question why you're there, you can't stop doing it. Every mission, everything we did, kicking doors in, disrupting people's lives, bagging people's heads, bagging a dude's head and dragging him out of a house while his kids are standing there screaming. For what? What are we doing?
Corporal Elliott, now father to a young daughter, still keeps their copy of Don't Sweat the Small Stuff.
The solution is to notice what's happening in your head.
The book's message guiding him long after combat.
I've had a few low points in my journey of just wellness and healing since getting out of the Marines. That journey is include getting a DUI at some point. I was feeling just so low and disconnected. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know who I had no identity other than Marine.
Upon returning from Iraq, he retired his Marine uniform.
I chose to discharge. I did not want to go back to war. My experience in Iraq just involved witnessing suffering after suffering. How do I have meaning in my life when I felt really powerless in Iraq? I felt trapped.
For some, that constant danger always being on edge, creating a new kind of battle when returning to civilian life.
We were used to living in the extremes. Everything I did in combat is not going to work in civilian life. Now I have to relearn again. And how do I take care of myself? I'm going to drink. I'm going to numb myself. I'm going to drink until I pass out. Some of my lowest points, I've wanted to not be here anymore. There are more of us that died by suicide in my unit than were killed in Iraq.
I just was thinking, I'm a burden on my family, I'm a burden on my wife, my kids. I abused alcohol. I've tried to find whatever way I could to find happiness, peace, serotonin, whatever I could find, you know?
After the war, at least three Fox 25 Marines die by suicide. One of them is in prison for murder after allegedly suffering from PTSD.
I think the nation didn't know what to do with a fresh round of combat veterans. What's the rule book for transitioning home?
These Marines are a snapshot of an alarming reality for American vets. Just in 2019, 17 veterans died by suicide every single day. About 30% of veterans who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan have been diagnosed with lifetime PTSD. Nearly 13% of homeless adults are veterans.
Do you ever regret having served as a Marine?
You know, I've tried to regret it because I did terrible things. I don't regret it, though, and I gotta say, it's weird because it's not regret, it's something else. I regret that all that happened.
After leaving the Marines, Heisel went to college, landed a dream job in local government, had a second child. He's making music with his 18-year-old son.
Tell me about your track, Killer. What's the significance of that song?
I'm a killer of men.
It's really just, it's me proclaiming the truth, saying, I'm a killer. And I had a therapist when I first got back. She said, once you admit that you are a killer, you did kill people, move on. There's not anything I can do about it. When you're going to war, it's unchangeable history.
How are you now, 20 years later?
I'm pretty good. I had to take care of some stuff, though. It's tough, man.
Captain Johnson, the son of a Marine, has risen through the ranks. Now a colonel, he will retire soon.
You learned that you need to be careful and choose your battles wisely. So I think there's some wisdom that warriors learn that war is a high-stakes, serious undertaking.
Elliott went on to graduate college and is a physical therapist, rehabilitation specialist.
Even with support and all the encouragement from my friends, it's only been a couple of years even recently where I've experienced this inner peace.
No greater friend, no worse enemy, goes the Marine motto. Because of their sacrifice, most Americans will never know the true cost of war.
Do you think the U.S. has learned any lessons since the Iraqi invasion?
No, I don't think so. American civilians didn't learn anything because their lives didn't change at all.
the relief of coming home, but also with the pain and the sorrow of experiencing war and what that looked like. And it breaks my heart that the journey for some post-military service has gotten even more difficult. It's a hard journey, and you have to decide if it's worth it.
ABC's Byron Pitts, three Marines who fought in the war in Iraq. Coming up, abortion bans across the country continue to be hotly debated, and one Texas couple is seeing the impact firsthand on Perspective after this. From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, rising numbers of diabetes cases across the country, why and how to prevent it. But first, for many, maybe most Americans, the topic of abortion and overturning Roe v. Wade isn't a life or death issue. It's an academic matter, the stuff of arguments at family gatherings. But for a young family in Texas, the issue has become very personal. ABC's Jim Ryan has the story from Dallas.
After COVID-19 put their attempts to grow their family on hold, Seth and Kylie Beaton began 2023 anticipating the birth of their second child. Early visits to the obstetrician brought only good news. At the couple's 20-week checkup on January 9th.
So it was a little boy.
I was really excited when we found out it was a boy, but that was short-lived.
After determining the gender of the baby, the doctor continued the ultrasound exam.
As he was looking at the rest of the body, he discovered that the head, that there was essentially no brain there. There was a brain stem, but as he kind of ventured up, you could just see it was just a kind of all dark.
The exam revealed a rare and tragic condition. Dr. Carrie Rouse is an OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine specialist at Indiana University Health.
Alobar holoprosencephaly is a rare congenital anomaly, which means that it occurs during development of the fetus while in utero. It occurs in about 1 in 10,000 live births.
Dr. Rouse is not the Beaton's physician, but is familiar with the condition their baby has developed.
Most of these infants do not live past a year.
Suddenly, Kylie Beaton, who had never held strong opinions about abortion one way or the other, was left with a heartbreaking choice: to give birth to a child whose life would be short and painful, or to terminate the pregnancy. She and her husband chose the latter, but they were told by their doctor,
"My hands are tied. I can't do anything unless you develop a, you know, severe health issue like preeclampsia, where your health is essentially in jeopardy. Then we can induce."
Texas, which the Beatons call home, had some of the nation's strictest abortion laws even before Roe v. Wade came down. It's a second-degree felony for a medical professional to perform, induce, or attempt an abortion, and a first-degree felony if the abortion is carried out. Governor Greg Abbott.
Our goal is to make sure we protect the lives of both the mother and the baby. And there's been too many allegations that have been made about ways in which the lives of the mother are not being protected. And so that must be clarified.
Protecting the physical life of the mother is one thing, but Kylie Beaton was faced with the emotional anguish of carrying a non-viable pregnancy to term. She and her husband traveled to New Mexico, where a pregnancy could be terminated at 23 weeks. But there they were told,
"Unfortunately, the size of the head is larger from last week, and we can't perform the procedure because the head is already measuring at 23 weeks and a couple days."
Tragically, the growth of the head was due to a buildup of fluid, not the growth of a healthy brain.
I'm just terrified for my wife. I mean, she's the strongest person I know, and she's just helpless right now. And it's not fair for her and other women. And we have a daughter. I couldn't imagine my daughter ever having to do this. It just breaks my heart thinking that people have to do this.
For now, all the Beatons, Kylie, Seth, and their 4-year-old daughter, Rinley, can do is wait.
The baby could survive maybe an hour, a day, but the longevity or the likelihood, the max, is anywhere for a couple weeks.
If it survives.
And Kylie, who never felt strongly about abortion, now has firm opinions on the matter. She would ask Texas lawmakers if she could.
"Do you know what this condition is? Do you know what this is? And I bet you not one of them could tell you exactly what that is." And that's the issue, is because they don't know. So how are you going to make a law for women when you don't know, you're not educated, and you're not in that position or considered the possibility of these conditions?
As of this week, 14 states have imposed total or near total bans on abortion. Reporting for Perspective, Jim Ryan, ABC News, Dallas.
Coming up, the fight over water in the American West heads to the U.S. Supreme Court on Perspective after this. Welcome back to Perspective from ABC News. In addition to releasing its latest report chronicling the rapidly warming planet and what countries need to do to turn things around, the UN also this week held a conference on water, concluding that globally around 2 billion people don't have access to safe drinking water, and that up to 2.5 billion could be facing water scarcity by the year 2050. In the American West, there's a fight over water that's gone all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It involves communities who get their water from the Colorado River, including the Navajo Nation. ABC's Brad Milkey talked about it with Devin Dwyer, who covers the Supreme Court for us here at ABC News as a part of our daily podcast. Start here.
The Colorado River is perhaps the most litigated and carved up water body in this country. Enter the Navajo Nation, one of the country's largest Native American tribes, whose reservation, the largest reservation in the country, sits in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. They're fighting for a greater slice of that water, and that could upend the delicate balance of agreements that has been worked out over the years. Mm. And so they were in the Supreme Court asking the justices to force the government to help them get a bigger slice. The tribe has alleged that a 170-year-old treaty, a treaty of 1868, which created the reservation, implicitly put a duty on the government to help them have water to live there. The treaty doesn't use the word water, but says the government has agreed to help them have a permanent home, one where they can farm and subsist. And they told the justices, well, that inherently means we got to have some access to water and the government has to help provide it. Of course, the government, Brad says, we never explicitly agreed to provide water, much less any specific amount of water. And while we care about you and want to help you and have spent billions of dollars over the years, this claim simply is without merit. And so the justices are going to have to weigh that. And I got to say, there's a lot of love for the tribe, Brad.
Well, yeah, because I'm trying to figure out, Devin, what would make the difference here? Would it matter, like, who was here first? Because then you'd imagine, like, obviously the Navajo win. Who is the most aggrieved? The Navajo win. Or are you going by the most number of Americans impacted? Because then you could imagine maybe that changes the equation.
That's certainly one way to frame the debate. The tribe says, listen, we were here first. We get first dibs. And I'm sorry you have these other agreements, but you got to honor your promises, that the government made. On the other hand, you had a group of states. You had the federal government, the Biden administration saying, listen, this is a very carefully calibrated set of agreements that has been sorted out for a really long time. All of these states are dependent upon it. And now if you're going to inject this tribe's new request into that game and, you know, it's a zero-sum, you know, game. Mm. Some of that water will be taken away from other people. And that really upsets the apple cart, to mix metaphors there. But they, the justices were very sympathetic. Neil Gorsuch, conservative, whose roots are back in Colorado, in the West, right, has a lot of love for the Native American tribes and this the fact that the government needs to uphold its promise. On the other hand, you had someone like Justice Samuel Alito, who was very concerned about the impact of allowing a claim of this nature to go forward. And at the end of the day, Brad, the tribe simply repeated, they have 1 in 3 households on that reservation don't have running water.
Wow.
And they say that's just, it is a travesty. It's one of the poorest reservations in the country. Very simple subsistence. Of course, it's hot, it's arid. And they say, listen, we were forced onto this land with the promise that we could live here. And the government needs to step up and do more to help us.
ABC's Devin Dwyer with Brad Milkey on Start Here. Coming up, a one-day wake-up call on the seriousness of diabetes, especially for communities of color, on Perspective after this. Welcome back to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Sherry Preston. This coming Tuesday, March 28th, is American Diabetes Alert Day. The whole idea, to raise awareness about the risks and symptoms of a disease that affects 1 in every 10 Americans. Soon that number is expected to be even higher. According to the CDC, without significant changes in eating and lifestyle, by the year 2050, 1 in 3 Americans could be diagnosed with diabetes. Chris Bryant from Woodbridge, New Jersey, was diagnosed when he was 16.
You know, when you're 16, you just want to fit in with your friends, eat the foods they eat and hang out with them. And that led me to being not paying attention to the diabetes as I should have.
As happens a lot in life, a significant other finally got him to change his ways.
It's not until I got married that my wife and I had a conversation and said, if you're going to marry me, you got to take better care of yourself. It was more of a demand, if you will.
By that point, however, the damage had been done. Chris has type 1 diabetes, an autoimmune disease where cells that make insulin in the pancreas can be destroyed. That leads to low or absent levels of insulin, a hormone you need for cells to absorb sugar and give you energy. Type 2 diabetes occurs when your cells don't respond normally to insulin, and it's usually caused by lifestyle factors. Both types, however, if left untreated, can lead to serious health problems, including damage to your eyes, heart, and kidneys, which is what happened to Chris. He needed eye surgery and then dialysis. A lot of people he met also on dialysis also had diabetes.
Many of them are waiting for a kidney transplant, which in my case, I received my first kidney transplant from a living donor.
Chris now works at the Diabetes Foundation, a nonprofit organization based in Mahwah, New Jersey, not affiliated with the American Diabetes Association. Executive Director Janine Salenti works to help clients control their diabetes and says she's particularly worried about the number of Americans in black and brown communities because the numbers show black adults are nearly twice as likely as white adults to develop type 2 diabetes.
So a recent study that was released by the Peter G. Peterson Foundation showed that in 2021, the median household income of black and Hispanic households in the Northeast had lower income by $20,000 to $30,000. What does this do? It limits the ability to see doctors, to obtain healthy foods, to access medication. And what it's doing is putting our neighbors at a disadvantage and a greater risk.
Janet Zappi, who runs the diabetes care and specialist team at The Ohio State University, lists the inability to see doctors in the hours that doctors work as one of the biggest challenges facing some in the African American community.
You know, their employer's not giving them ill time. They work for a small company or they're a small business owner and they can't afford to get off. So I think just getting to the care is probably number one. I think number two, access to specialists. It can take months, quite honestly, to get in to see a true specialist. If you're on government insurance, you definitely have fewer and fewer providers willing to take that insurance.
Researchers have been making real strides in diabetes treatments in the past few years, including the insulin pump, continuous glucose monitoring, and most recently, devices that connect both those things together, delivering micro doses of insulin exactly when the patient needs it.
The accuracy of it is amazing. And in the last year, one of the pumps on the market is actually tubeless. So it looks like a little mouse and it goes on the skin. And those two devices are just talking back and forth and give some insulin, hold some insulin. Yeah, it's amazing.
Using pumps, monitoring, helping with doctor's appointments, and discussing lifestyle changes are some of the key things that Chris Bryant tries to emphasize at the Diabetes Foundation when he coaches those who've recently been diagnosed with it. Bryant had a second kidney transplant 3 years ago, and at the time, he also got a new pancreas from the same donor. He says his life hasn't been easy, and he still has plenty of bad days. But he actually likes talking about his journey now because it gives him a sense of purpose.
Most people would think that it's a tough thing that I wouldn't want to talk about, but I enjoy talking about it because if I can help just one person and to get better management, then I feel I done my job.
Diabetes Alert Day, something to be aware of, next Tuesday, March 28th. And finally,
Impossible Theater. The regal excellence of Japan, the overwhelming talent of the United States. And in a one-run game with two gone in the ninth inning, the dream matchup.
The 2023 World Baseball Classic became a classic in its own right. Not only do the U.S. and Japan face off in an edge-of-your-seat championship matchup, but with the game on the line, two teammates in the majors, the Angels' Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani, would decide the outcome.
Trout's ready. 3-2. He struck him out! Ohtani strikes out Trout, and Japan's back on top of the baseball world.
Fox Sports with a call. Despite several of the games generating millions of viewers, there are some who believe it's nothing more than an exhibition. So, what gives? We spoke with Brian Clark. In addition to being an anchor here at ABC News, he's also an in-house reporter for the New York Yankees.
Easiest way to think about it is basically a World Cup for baseball, just what the name thinks. You know, we have the World Series in Major League Baseball. It's kind of a false name. because that's only teams from the U.S. You don't have teams from all over the world playing in it. Here, it's players representing their countries or countries they're affiliated with playing for those countries. Now, obviously, baseball is not soccer, so it doesn't have as broad of a global appeal, but you're certainly seeing it grow, and it's huge in parts of the world. Obviously, here in the U.S., you go down to Latin America, Asia, of course, with Japan winning the World Baseball Classic, and it's getting bigger in Europe. I mean, the Czech Republic, it's taken off there. England has a team. There's some former Major League players and stars getting involved in having teams in England. There'll be a Major League game in the U.K. later this year. There was one a few years ago. So it's essentially trying to stand up this World Cup of baseball, and it's less than 20 years old. The first one was in 2006.
But why doesn't this get as much support here in the U.S.?
There's a lot of different reasons. One is there's a lot going on right now. It's the middle of March. It's March Madness. I think the fact that it is still new has people kind of wondering, wait, this is still a thing? And it's also been on this sort of uneven pattern in terms of years. 2006 was the first. 2009 was the second, so that's 3 years. Then it was 2013, so we wait four more for 2017. But then, of course, COVID, there was the lockout last year. So it's been 6 years since we last had a World Baseball Classic. So figuring out that part, figuring out the time in the sports calendar, and this is going to be the time because you're not going to play it after the season because guys are exhausted and injured and need to recover and start thinking about the next year. Baseball in the U.S. in many ways is more of a regional sport now. You know, this is not 1955 anymore, but it's still huge here in New York where we are. It's still huge in Los Angeles, St. Louis. There are great baseball cities, Boston. But on the whole, it doesn't move the national needle like the NFL does.
And final question to you, Brian, why should we care?
Because it's the best on the best. And just think of that last at-bat in the championship game where you've got two of the best players in the world who are teammates for the Los Angeles Angels and Shohei Ohtani for Japan, Mike Trout for the U.S. Mike Trout, who, by the way, was essentially recruiting other people to play for the U.S. because players have to step up and volunteer. This is the first time the U.S. and Major League Baseball did not have to twist arms. They were full in terms of the number of people who came forward to play. So you have Mike Trout, Captain America, let's call him. He and the Angels famously have never been that successful. Now Shohei Ohtani's been added to that mix as well. Shohei Ohtani is one of the best pitchers in baseball. He's also one of the best hitters in baseball. We haven't seen that since Babe Ruth, and that was over 100 years ago in a very different segregated sport. So you have these two guys who are teammates professionally, but with their flags on their backs and on their hats, squaring off for the title, and it coming down to best on best. You can't ask for anything more than that. Just goes to show why this was so special and why I think it's got a lot of potential.
ABC's Brian Clark. Thanks, Brian. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show is produced by Aaron Ferrer and Marwa Mwaki. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.